Hey, it's Big Joe for Absolute Comfort, your trusted independent American Standard Air dealer. And owner Chris Wedekin sells the Mitsubishi Electric Mini Split, a great option for heating and cooling where ductwork can't be installed.
If you have one of those homes that has baseboard heat or electric heat, ceiling cable heat, these can be specifically designed for those houses, because in those houses, it's very difficult having to do all the construction and remodeling that goes with adding ductwork into those types of homes.
Find out more by going to AbsoluteComfort.org. Absolute Comfort is your trusted independent American Standard Air Mitsubishi Electric Elite Ductless Pro dealer.
We turn our attention now to Colts beat reporter and insider for the Indy Star, Joel Erickson, nice enough to take some time with us. Joel, you had a piece a couple days ago, regarding the Colts coaching search and how the fronts have kind of quieted a bit for the two big names, both with Jim Harbaugh and with Sean Payton. Where did that news take you at all yesterday in terms of the pulse of the Colts situation as they continue to navigate through interviews for their next head coach?
Well, at the very least, it kind of clarified those situations, because with Harbaugh, you know, there had been a lot of line drawing, speculation, whatever you want to call it, that had sort of said, this is going to be the guy, the guy to watch in this search. But there hadn't been really much in the way of hard evidence of that since the start of the search. There hadn't been any reports. He'd been reported to have talked to Tepper in Carolina. Obviously, there was plenty of reporting that linked him to Denver, but there hadn't really been anything hard linking him to the Colts. And so it just sort of took the specter out of it, because we've been obviously tracking who they've been interviewing, who they've requested to interview. His name never came up in any of that stuff, and you started wondering, you know, everyone obviously drew this very obvious line from Ursay to Harbaugh, but is it really is he really a factor in this or not? And we got our answer yesterday, our hard answer yesterday.
Well, Chris Ballard said in his press conference, Joel, that he was open to interviewing college coaches for the head Colts job. Was that just Harbaugh, or do you think there will be some other college coaches that might get invited to interview?
I think if there were, well, you hate to say this, because then it turns around and then they interview Matt Campbell or somebody. But I feel like, given that most for college coaches the season's over, I think that if that was going to happen, it would have happened already. Especially with some of the time that they've had. So maybe, I mean, who knows if there's something they've been, one of the college coaches have been waiting for. But it sort of seems like that maybe isn't as big a deal, and we should be focusing more on these guys that they've interviewed and these coordinator types that they've been involved with.
Joel, the balance that the Colts are having to go through, like any teams do when their offseason starts early, is unique, because you're trying to fit in or navigate through these different interviews with teams that are still involved in the playoffs. D'Amico Ryans comes to mind, and Wink Martindale as well. Where does the playoffs, from a Colts perspective, impact their timeline, while also not wanting to get necessarily caught with their tail between their legs, so to speak, if other teams are in the same pool of coaches they've already interviewed and want to jump the gun for a team that isn't in the playoffs anymore? How do they navigate through that, and where is that impacted by the request they put out there for Wink Martindale and D'Amico Ryans?
Yeah, so I think what's gone on so far with this, you know, Chris Ballard, the search has played out the way Chris Ballard said it would the last time we talked to him. You know, it's a very wide net. Obviously, there's 11 reported candidates right now. Seven of them have interviewed. There's three to come. I think the timing on guys like Martindale and Kafka and Ryans has more to do with them being available this week. You know, Ryans is doing stuff at the end of the week. There was one report I saw that said Dable was not, they were not going to, the Giants guys weren't going to do anything, and I saw another one that they might get let do something at the end of the week, but those guys are available this week. They weren't last week. It seems like the Colts are sort of following the protocol. And in terms of, like, who they hire, Ballard made it very clear that he was willing to be patient. Now, if one of these guys blows them away, and maybe not willing to be patient, maybe that's not the right way to put it. Maybe the right way to put it is going into it with that desire to not miss anything, not leave any unturned stones, basically not end up in the situation they ended up with Josh McDaniels. I think that's the thing that jumped to everybody's mind correctly. And so, you know, if one of their big time candidates went down the road a ways with, you know, Denver or somebody like that, I think maybe they'd have to kick it in gear. But I don't see anything like that going on right now, because for some of those other jobs, you know, the specter of, like, Sean Payton is interviewing in three of those places this week, might be interviewing with Arizona soon. You know, there's a bunch of different places. Payton's availability sort of slows everything down, and it gives the Colts a chance to wait, I think.
Are you surprised that Gus Bradley hasn't been asked to interview?
No, not necessarily. You know, it seems like the league has kind of decided that Gus is a defensive coordinator at this point, and maybe not a head coach. So I guess I'm not super surprised. He hasn't really gotten a lot of head coaching interviews over the last couple since he was the head coach of the Jaguars. So no, I'm not super surprised.
Joel, when you look at where the Colts are at in terms of this unique balancing act they're going to have to be a part of for the draft coming up in 3 months or 4 months from now, and you look at the coaching search ongoing, this popped into our head yesterday when we were talking about it. Are the Colts going to trade up? And that's a whole nother can of worms, but the Texans are frequently going to be a specter in my mind over these next couple of months, as they both are in a similar situation trying to rebuild. That brings me to Sean Payton. There's been no, it appears anyway, formal interest on his part in regard to the Colts. Is there expected, from your reporting and what you've seen, any type of push on their front to try to have an interview with him?
I know the Colts, I should say Nick Underhill, who I used to work with and who is kind of the guy who knows stuff in New Orleans, reported last week that that all five teams had at least inquired, which means that means the Colts too. That includes them. Obviously, they're the only team that hasn't been mentioned as being granted a chance to interview. And when Sean Payton was talking, I mean, he obviously was kind of way more open yesterday about the search on Colin Cowherd's show, on his daughter's podcast, than I think most people would expect a coaching candidate to be. You know, he didn't mention the Colts. He mentioned a lot of the other teams by name. He never mentioned the Colts. Hasn't done it. There hasn't been much smoke there. Now, that could be a couple of different things. That could just mean that the Colts inquired, found out what the Saints would want from them, because obviously you have to trade for Sean Payton, and they said, no, we're not willing to do that for a head coach. Payton said on the Cowherd show, you know, a mid to late first-round pick, the Colts have the number four pick and obviously the franchise quarterback. So you're probably not giving that up. I think if you're going to give up a high pick for Sean Payton, it's because you feel like you have your quarterback and most of your roster in place. But yeah, it just doesn't seem like there's anything really going on there beyond just they checked in on him, saw what it might take. And either one of two things is true, or maybe both things is true. Either the Colts didn't like what they had in terms of compensation, or Sean Payton didn't like what he saw in terms of the Colts.
I get the feeling, and I may be wrong, but I get the feeling that this is all window dressing. And at the end of the day, Jeff Saturday is going to be the Colts coach next year.
Well, I mean, that's the thing is, I think everyone kind of has the same view on that, and it's probably the correct one. If that happens, it's up to Jim Irsay doing that. Ballard said, you know, he's leading the process. He's going to lead the search. They're going to present their findings to Irsay, and Irsay will make the final decision. And I think that's the scenario where Saturday ends up being the head coach, is that Irsay just decides to go with the guy he brought in as the interim unexpectedly, rather than go with one of these, you know, guys that they've interviewed.
Joel, to Brian's point, because I've half talked about that the last couple of weeks with a slight mix of tongue in cheek, but also a reality of billionaire owners are going to do what billionaire owners want to do. And there's not much sense trying to read tea leaves into that. To your point, at the end of the day, if Jim Irsay wants Jeff Saturday to be the next coach, whether he thinks that Jeff didn't get a fair shake the last couple of weeks, whether he wants to see what this looks like long term, it's ultimately his decision. But in terms of the rest of West 56, then as you're navigating this story, how legitimate is that concept? Or is it just a because Brian Quilly has it, I have it as well. Is it a fear or a legitimate acquisition that could happen for the Colts this offseason? How real is that for Jeff Saturday being named the full-time head coach?
Well, I think the fact that he was named interim it shows you that it's real. I mean, no one would have guessed that or said that going into it. I don't think anyone would guess that or say that based on what we've seen from Saturday, the Jeff Saturday version of the Colts after he was the interim. I mean, obviously they went 1-7 with a negative 87 point differential. They had some historic losses in there. There's not a lot there. There's no case really from the football side, but that's what people were saying when they hired him as the interim was there's nothing here to suggest that this is a possibility. So it's realistic because the thing I keep thinking about is if there's anything we should have learned from this Colts season, it's that anything can happen at any time, and trying to guess it based on the way things have gone precedent wise, or what you're used to seeing, maybe is not the best way to look at it. So I think everything's realistic just because everything has ended up being realistic this season.
I'll be honest with you. I'm a little bit intrigued as to what the Colts would look like if Jeff Saturday is the head coach. What would his coaching staff look like? What would he do differently having the whole season to prepare rather than being parachuted in the middle of the season? And I would imagine, Joel, a little bit in the back of your mind, you've got to be a little bit intrigued too with that scenario because it would certainly make for some good stories.
Maybe. Maybe. My experience is that if things got worse down the stretch there, people sort of tuned out on the good stories around the Colts, and they just wanted to read about conflict. So I don't know if it's the best thing. I guess this is the thing. To me, the idea that there was nothing that he could do to change the fortunes of the team at all is a hard sell for me. It's a hard sell because of the history of interim coaches. The 1-7 finish was the worst for any interim coach with more than six games in 20 years, more than 20 years. And so I understand that obviously you don't have systems in place, scheduling, that kind of thing, and that they were down some offensive coaches. But I just feel like that, like, two decades of history tells you that an interim can generally do better than Saturday did. And so for me, the on-field stuff is what sticks out there.
Brian, I'm chuckling because the way you describe that, I'm fascinated by it, because in the same way I'd be fascinated by someone that's going to get in a cage with a tiger, like, oh, what's this guy doing? I can't wait to see what happens next.
That's kind of what I'm thinking, yeah.
Joel A. Erickson joining us via the Mower Shop and Fishers Hotline, themowershop.com, for all your residential commercial mowers, as well as snowblowers, power equipment, tools, so much more. They have you covered at the Mower Shop and Fishers and themowershop.com. It's been a good mix of both offensive and defensive coordinators over their interview process to this point, Joel. Through the interviews that have been had to this point, Eric Bieniemy, Raheem Morris, to name a few, obviously Bubba Ventrone in-house, what has been your takeaways from those interviews so far? And does this, in your mind, need to be an offensive-focused mind at the top job on West 56th?
I don't think it necessarily has to be an offensive-focused mind. I know that most of the coaches left in the playoffs now are offensive-minded backgrounds or offense, or they have offensive histories. But I think it's obviously possible to have a defensive-minded or otherwise-minded head coach and be successful. The Ravens are out now. John Harbaugh came from special teams. He's a very good coach, 60% winning percentage over his career, has a Super Bowl. Sean McDermott might be the best example of the fact that a defensive coach can help a young quarterback if he brings the right people in around him on staff. Because obviously McDermott's a defensive coordinator with the Panthers. He gets hired in Buffalo. He doesn't really have any quarterback chops. I think that one of the things with Carolina and the teams that he was a part of in Carolina was sort of that they could never get Cam Newton beyond what Cam Newton always was, in theory, you would talk down on the idea of when they get hired of Sean McDermott developing a quarterback. But his quarterback is Josh Allen, who everybody thought coming out was going to be terrible because he was too raw and wasn't accurate, and instead has developed into one of the two best quarterbacks in the league. Now, obviously, Brian Daboll has a big part in that. Like, the guys that he's hired on the offensive staff are a big part in that. But it shows that it's possible. It shows that it's possible to get those guys in there and hire staff members who can develop the quarterback and can focus on the quarterback while the head coach handles head coaching duties.
The I lost my train of thought. I'm sitting over here with a great question, and I lost my train of thought.
Happens to the best of us.
Oh, no, draft. Let's talk draft. Do you think the Colts will stay at number four, or do you think they're going to try to move up?
That's a good question. Based on past history, my general reaction would be that the Colts are going to stay put. Now,
isn't that dangerous, though?
Yes, and that's where I was going to go next. Like, so I asked Ballard point blank during his press conference, if you thought a guy was the right guy, would you move heaven and earth? Would you go up to number one to get him? He unequivocally said yes. And I think that given where they have this pick, how rare it is generally for this franchise to have this high pick. Now, who knows what's going to happen going forward. But how rare it's been for this franchise to have this high pick, you have to capitalize on it. And whoever comes out on top of your draft board, I personally wouldn't want any chance of losing them. I just wouldn't. Even if it's not what everybody says, even if you decide to say that, you know, C.J. Stroud is better than Bryce Young and he's your guy, and everyone is saying Bryce Young's going to be the number one pick, I just wouldn't be able to count on that. Because there's three picks in front of you that can be moved. People can move up into them. Someone can make a different thing, can decide the same thing you did. If I think a guy is the guy, I do whatever it takes to make sure that I get him. I don't want him going anywhere else. I want him in my building, regardless of what it takes. Because here's the thing. If you get it right, no one cares what you gave up. No one cares. Like, the Chiefs and the Bills moved up to get their guys. Nobody cares or even sort of remembers what they gave up to get him because they ended up getting the right guy. So it's about getting the right guy. And unless they're all graded similarly and you feel like they all have the same shot, which seems to me to be – that would be a remarkable occurrence, I'd be trying to move up to get the guy I wanted.
How much do you think the opinions of these quarterbacks will change when we get to the combine? Because we always see, you know, the draft order, you know, all these Mel Kuypers of the world. That always changes after the combine. How much do you think that might happen with these quarterbacks?
I think that there generally tends to be some moving over the course of the process. Like, I think about, you know, Zach Wilson somehow ending up at number two when going into that college football season, it was always supposed to be Trevor and Justin, Trevor and Justin, Trevor and Justin, and then Fields dropping to 11. So I think there'll be some movement. Predicting how that is and what's going to happen with it is kind of hard because some of it just depends on, like, I could see Anthony Richardson making a big move up in sort of the Trey Lance way where you just love the tools so much that you're interested in what he can do from that standpoint. I could see Will Levis and his throwing of the ball, his ability to throw the ball and make all the throws, sort of moving him up in kind of the Wilson way. Because, you know, there was that pro day where Wilson was running left and threw a bomb down the field, and everyone was talking about that. So I think that there's a possibility that one of those guys could end up shuffling the draft order. Trying to guess who it is really hard.
Joel, you have a piece up on the Indy Star right now entitled Why Jeff Saturday's CEO Style Approach Bucks the NFL's Head Coaching Trend. You've kind of referenced the fact that a lot of these successful head coaches of the last 15, 20 years, Bruce Arians, Doug Peterson, Andy Reid, Bill Belichick, to name a few, have all had different innovative capabilities versus, you reference Mike Tomlin, John Harbaugh as the CEO types that are true leadership guys, but that you're able to build great systems around them. We all know this is a treacherous time in terms of the direction of the Colts franchise where they might be bringing in a young quarterback. Is that concerning, having that style of coach that's going to emphasize so much on his coordinators and his staff while also trying to potentially build a quarterback of the future in this year's draft?
I think it's twofold. I think it's partially the quarterback thing, but more the thing that sticks out to me is more that a quarterback who has an expertise in one side of X's and O's or the other, whether or not they're actually coordinating the offense and calling the plays or coordinating the defense and calling the plays, then has the ability to stretch his coordinators and test them and get them to move their schemes in a different way. They can have a meeting and say, hey, this is what I'm seeing in the defense. Can we do more of this so that offenses can't attack you in this way? Or vice versa. Same thing going the other way on the other side of the ball. I think that's part of the reason that you have – well, I mean, one of the other things is you heard Jeff Saturday all through his time there basically say, well, we're down three coaches on the offensive side of the ball. Well, technically, he replaced one of those coaches. Right. He replaced Frank Reich and couldn't do the same things that Frank Reich would be able to do in terms of building an offensive scheme, transforming an offensive scheme, fitting the players who was in there. It's that when you have a head coach who's capable of doing that, who's willing to do that X's and O's stuff, it adds more manpower to the room. Doesn't mean he has to be the play caller. Doesn't mean he has to be the coordinator. But it helps to have a coach who can test and stretch and add something when you're looking for answers.
In your opinion, is there a leader in the clubhouse as far as the coaching search is concerned?
I don't think so. Not at this point. They're still gathering. You know, they've still got at least three more interviews, and I think there's a chance of a couple more. You know, with some of these guys that are still in the playoffs, like. I wonder if we see a Kellen Moore or Dan Quinn get an interview here. So right now it seems like from Ballard's process, the way he set it up, again, the ultimate decision rests with Irsay. But the way Ballard's process set it up, I think he wants to sort of gather the whole field and then figure out what's next.
Joel, to that end, and this might be a question that you don't have the answer to, Ballard is obviously managing this process, as is Colts ownership, but that rug that could be pulled out from under you of Jeff Saturday, is this a dynamic that Ballard is just rolling with the punches with as a general manager under contract, holding one of the most coveted jobs in all of sport and just being accepting of that the owner is ultimately going to make the decision? Or is there a tug and pull understanding that one of these candidates has just as much of a shot to be the guy as potentially Jeff Saturday at the end of the day?
Yeah, when I asked Ballard that question specifically, he pushed back on it. Now, whether or not that's his actual feelings or not, I think it's anybody's guess, or whether it's actually going to work that way is anybody's guess, because they have to say it's going to be an open and thorough
right.
search. They absolutely have to. So, there's so much of this just comes down to what's going on in Jim Irsay's mind. What does he want to do? Is he open to changing the coach away from Jeff Saturday? In his mind, was Jeff Saturday the only coach going forward? Because I did not get that from Chris Ballard's press conference at all. I didn't get that he was a leader, the leader in the clubhouse. You know, Ballard said he's a candidate, and I'd be interested to hear what his vision is. That's the kind of stuff you could say about any of these guys. Irsay, though, obviously holds the ultimate trump card, and Ballard acknowledged that. There were a couple times that Ballard said, Irsay's going to make some football decisions that I'm going to disagree with. Or he's made some football decisions that I disagreed with. So that's the ultimate wild card here, is what does Jim Irsay want to do?
Joel A. Erickson, nice enough to take some time with us, Colts insider for the Indy Star, analyst on Fox 59 and CBS 4, and host over at the Star of the Colts Cover 2 podcast. Joel, always appreciate you making time for us and look forward to the continued conversations as the search unfolds.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, guys.
Whether it's audiobooks or all-time greatest hits, long live listening to your favorites. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you.
Joining us now is the radio voice of the Purdue Boilermakers, Rob Blackman. Rob, thanks for joining us.
Brian, one question for you.
Uh-oh.
Am I on the invite list for your golf outing this spring?
Absolutely you are. Can you bring Zach Edey with you? I'd like to see him play golf.
Oh, well, you know, he was a heck of a pitcher and a hockey player before he hit the 7-foot plateau. So, yeah, maybe I can talk him to doing that, too. How are you guys doing?
Good, good. Now, you know, every game, every road game, I think, okay, this is the one that Purdue's going to lose. Because, you know, they've played in some pretty hostile environments. At Ohio State, the Palestra was a great environment. Yesterday at the Breslin Center. Yet they just keep piling up road wins. It's been very impressive.
Yeah, you're right. 5-0 in true road games this year, and we do include that game at the Palestra as a road game because it was a true road environment. You're right, and I'm like you, Brian. I find myself going into these games thinking, well, this is probably the game we're going to get tripped up here, and I certainly thought that would be the case at Michigan State yesterday just because that's just kind of what happens at the Breslin Center. That's an awfully tough place to play. Now, Purdue did catch a little bit of a break when we found out Malik Hall was not going to play yesterday for Michigan State. But, look, the fact of the matter is Purdue is not only winning road games, as I mentioned, 5-0 in true road games, the only team in high major basketball that can claim to be 5-0 in true road games. But they're also, what I like about it, Brian and Jimmy, what I really like is they're winning one-possession games, and the games that are coming right down to the wire. Beat Ohio State on the road in a one-possession game. Beat Nebraska in a very hostile environment in overtime in a one-possession game. They went a one-possession game yesterday, obviously, against Michigan State. So I'm just as excited about the fact that Purdue's finding a way to win these one-possession games that come down to ultimately what are literally the final play of the game. They're finding a way to win those games. And that's probably what has me even more excited than the fact that Purdue's winning these road games.
Rob, to your point about handling those one-possession games, somebody asked Matt Painter yesterday post-game about chess match-like play against another cerebral head coach in Tom Izzo and just how the last moments of that game unfolded. He referenced the fact that you know he's won every which way, he's been beaten every which way as well. From your vantage point, what was it like taking in that chess match and as you saw things operate down the stretch in what turned out to be a duel between Edey and Walker in a way?
Yeah, and that's the thing, Jimmy, it was Edey and Walker. And that made it a lot of fun just as a fan of college basketball to watch those two guys do their thing. Zach, I know, had 32 and 17, and Walker, I think, ended up with 30. And so it was no surprise at the end of the game, both teams were going to throw the ball to their best player. And when you knew that, look, everyone in the building, including Tom Izzo, knew that ball was going into Zach Edey, and he delivered. And I think everyone in the building knew on the final shot of the game that Tyson Walker would be taking that shot for Michigan State. And why not? That guy's been red hot. But that was a big, you know, that was a fun part of it. The thing, too, you talk about the chess match. You think about this now. These are the two most veteran coaches in our league. Now, Tom's been there 28 years. Matt's been there 18. So that's a lot of game film. That's a lot of scouting reports that have been put away in the filing cabinets on each other. So when these two guys play one another, there really are no secrets. I mean, you know exactly what it's going to take to beat these guys. I made the comment with Matt when I did our pregame interview for the show yesterday. I said something to the effect of, you know, I've been on the broadcast crew for 18 years, and every time that we have played Michigan State in the last 18 years, the pregame chat with you is always centered around rebounding and keeping Michigan State out of transition offense. That has never changed. In 18 years, that has never changed. And wouldn't you know it, yesterday Michigan State actually out-rebounded Purdue, which Purdue's the number one rebounding team in the country, plus 12 a game. Got out-rebounded by Michigan State, yet still found a way to win. But to your original point, yes, it's a great chess match to watch. Yes, the X's and O's between the two coaches are great, not only because they're the two most veteran coaches in the league, but because there are no secrets between these two. When you've played each other as long as they've been playing one another, now 18 straight years, two times a year, sometimes three times a year, it didn't come down to secrets or trick plays or anything like that. It just comes down to who can weather the storm and hang in there the longest and find a way to win, and that's what Purdue did yesterday.
I thought Tom Izzo's defensive strategy was interesting. He let Edey get his. He never didn't double much at all. Yeah. Usually one-on-one in the post and tried to shut everybody else down. And if it wasn't for Fletcher Lawyer, that would have worked.
Yeah, and I think if you're Tom Izzo and his staff, you probably are saying the same thing. If that's a big if, but if Fletcher Lawyer doesn't get going, that works out just peachy, and you win that game. Michigan did the same thing against Travion Williams, I think it was 3 years ago, Brian, where they chose not to double in the post. They just played him one-on-one, and Travion had a 30-point game, but Michigan won because Purdue, quite frankly, had no one else offensively. It was giving Purdue any type of a punch. So that strategy worked. So I was a little surprised that that's what Michigan State chose to do with Sissoko yesterday. They, as you said, they played, I don't know how many possessions in the post, probably 90% of them, where they just played singled up against Zach and let him get his. But it was, it's such a, you know, a sharp contrast to what Purdue had seen Friday against Nebraska, when Nebraska was bringing two, sometimes three guys at Zach and making others beat them. You know, that was their philosophy, was we're going to triple team you in the post and we're going to dare somebody else to make shots. So, which Fletcher made shots in that game as well. So I guess I'm interested to see not only for the, you know, the final 13 games of the regular season, Brian, but even into the postseason, what are teams going to do? What will be their defensive approach to Purdue? Will they go single up on Zach Edey and just say, hey, we're going to let him get his 30 points and 15 rebounds and hope to gosh that the other guys don't make shots? Or will they double the ball and get him out of his hands? The good news for Purdue, and more specifically Zach Edey, he's seen both ends of the spectrum and everything in between. So I don't think there's anything that's going to fool him the rest of the way this season. He's seen it all. Literally, when you say throw the kitchen sink at Zach Edey, he literally has the kitchen sink. It's been thrown at him this year, and he's responded pretty well in all of those games.
As Purdue goes through the Big Ten for the second time, do you think teams will switch up, you know, thinking, well, that didn't work the first time. Let's try something else.
Yeah, I think it all comes, Brian, I think it comes down to personnel, you know, and what with a lot of teams. You know, for instance, we're going to play Minnesota on Thursday, and they do not have a lot to offer as far as size. I mean, Trayton Thompson, I think 6'11", but he's like 215 pounds. Other than that, I don't know. I know Dawson Garcia, I think they list him at 6'10", maybe, but he's not a low post player. I think it's going to come down to, Brian, how many big guys do you have on your roster? Even seldom used guys. We saw that yesterday with Cooper. I mean, a guy that plays 6 minutes a game for Michigan State rarely gets in the game. Tom Izzo was using him a bunch just because he's a big body. He actually is big enough physically to at least stand next to Zach Edey and looks like he kind of belongs. I mean, no one really looks like you belong next to Zach Edey at 7'4", 300 pounds. But so I think it comes down to personnel and just how many big bodies do you have on your roster. If you have enough that you think you can just keep throwing big guys at Zach and try to wear him down, then God bless you. I'd say go for it. But if you're a smaller group that's just not going to be an option, then you're probably just going to go single up in a post, let Zach get his, and just stay tight with all the other shooters. And again, as I said earlier, just hope that Purdue has a bad shooting night.
Rob Blackman, nice enough to take some time for us via the Mower Shop and Fishers hotline and themowershop.com for all your residential and commercial mowers, as well as power tools, equipment, snow blowers, lawn mowers, so much more. They have you covered at the Mower Shop and Fishers and themowershop.com. Rob, switching away from Purdue for a second, I got a couple texts about this, and I just wanted to get your thoughts on it as you are our resident college basketball pulse outside of Nick Gardner a little bit later today. But Jeff Goodman just reporting that Northwestern's game at Iowa tonight postponed. Only six players available for the Wildcats due to COVID. Just your thoughts on that and that still being very much prevalent, not just within the Big Ten, but within college athletics as a whole.
I got to tell you, it caught me off guard there, Jimmy. I had not seen that. And I am very surprised, not only A, to hear that information, but B, to think that we're still having a concern with COVID. I mean, I'm trying to think back to even the COVID season. I think Purdue, if I remember correctly, only missed one game. I think Nebraska did not come to West Lafayette that year because of COVID. If I remember correctly, that was the only game Purdue missed on the schedule. That was originally scheduled. And that was actually in the height of COVID.
Right.
So the fact that we are a couple years removed and we're still having this concern, I don't know. Man, I hate to see that because I thought that was and maybe I'm naive. I suppose I am. But I thought that was behind us.
No, I don't.
And what really, if I'm just looking at it, quite frankly, from strictly a basketball standpoint and Big Ten standpoint, that's bad news for Northwestern because they have a chance to get to the NCAA tournament. They really have a good Chris has a really good team this year. They really guard. And they have a chance to do some real damage here and have a type of team that can get to an NCAA tournament. So I am hopeful that this is a short-term thing here and they can get everybody healthy. Again, just from strictly a basketball standpoint, Northwestern has a chance to be really good this year.
Yeah, I completely agree with you on that front. And just to kind of piggyback off that, Rob, I don't think you're naive. I kind of felt the same way, but I mean, I guess when you get down to, man, only six players available, there's only so much you can do, whether it's COVID or whether it's a flu bug. If you have only six players available, when you're a team, like you said, with Northwestern that has a lot on the line as the Big Ten season continues to unfold, they are moving that game. It per Jeff Goodman, it is tomorrow, not tonight now. A crazy headline in general, seeing only six players available, and then when you find out it's COVID, it's like you said, the whole thing comes 180 for sure.
That's some pretty quick healing, isn't it? We're canceling it today, but we're going to play tomorrow.
Just one night late. Now, are we sure that's COVID, or maybe just a couple of you guys have the stomach flu and you want to make sure they're ready to play?
Rob, you know, when you at the beginning of the season, you think, okay, Purdue starting two freshman guards, your expectations couldn't have been that high. How surprised are you at how well Braden Smith and Fletcher Lawyer have played?
Well, I am surprised. However, I've mentioned this numerous interviews I've done. Yet again, I refuse to listen to the head coach, Matt Painter, who was telling us all summer, we're going to be just fine. We're going to be just fine. I was one of the many fans pushing the panic button saying, oh, what do you mean? Well, there's no way. There's no way we can do this with two freshmen, true freshmen in the backcourt. And yet, once again, Coach Painter knew exactly what he was talking about. Granted, he gets to see those guys every day in practice. He knew what he was getting himself into. But, yeah, surprised, yes. If I'd have been a better listener this summer, then maybe I wouldn't have been surprised. But, I mean, you just look at some of the numbers, Brian. And I, of course, I had to put some stats together for the game yesterday. But, I mean, Fletcher Lawyer is shooting 44%, I think, in Big Ten play from three. He's averaging like 17 points a game in Big Ten games only from three. Braden Smith, you know, forget the fact that he's, you know, almost 10 points, five rebounds a game, which is pretty amazing for a guy that's 6 feet tall to get five rebounds a game. But, you know, he's at 44% from three on the season. So both have been more than capable shooters. And the other thing I like about him is it's not like they're getting their numbers against the really bad teams, right? Sometimes we see freshmen have some really big games early in the season when you're bringing in those mid-majors for guarantee games. And then once the Big Ten play begins, then they really start to slough off. But, I mean, Fletch had 27 Friday against Nebraska. He had 20 earlier in the year against Minnesota. He had 18 against Duke. I mean, 18 against Duke as a true freshman. And the same thing really for Braden. I mean, his best games have come against Ohio State and Marquette, who's a top 25 team, and Gonzaga. He was like 14.7 assists against Gonzaga. So that's probably what amazes me the most about those two guys. Not the fact that, well, yes, the fact that they are putting up some pretty monster numbers, but they're doing it against really good competition. Their numbers aren't tailing off now that Big Ten play has begun. So that's probably what I've enjoyed the most about watching those two guys do their thing out on the floor.
Rob, I had one more question for you on my front, and then I wanted to clarify something. The way Jeff Goodman worded his second tweet threw me off, so just to clarify, I guess I know we chuckled about it a second ago. It is still postponed. He says game is tomorrow, not tonight. I thought he was saying the game has been moved to tomorrow, not tonight. He was correcting his original tweet. So the game is tomorrow, but it's still postponed due to the six players. So there's been no rescheduling of that game. I just want to clarify that. That's still up in the air for when that'll be replayed. The last question I had on your front was, when you're on the doorstep of a Final Four a couple years ago, you know, obviously the mountain is always going to be bigger and bigger for Matt Painter and company. So I know they're not, you know, hanging their hat necessarily on a win against Michigan State. They'll enjoy it, but there's other goals they want to achieve. What, if anything, at this point, Rob, and I know you're going to get this question over the next couple of weeks, is different, or does anything feel different about this group compared to the last couple of years where there's been new heightened levels of expectation for Purdue basketball to some extent?
I feel like this group is just a little bit more cohesive than maybe some of the other groups we have had in the past, and that's not a knock on the other groups. The other groups maybe didn't need quite as much cohesiveness because they had a star player or two that could be, you know, could be the alpha male, and everyone else just kind of played their role. Now, look, Zach Edey's a star player. I mean, he's certainly a front runner for National Player of the Year, but he has a really, really good supporting cast surrounding him, and not just the guys we've already talked about in Lawyer and Braden Smith, but Gosh darn, Caleb Furst has really played at a high level. What a compliment he's been as a low post presence with Zach down there. Mason Gillis off the bench has played extremely well for this team. Ethan Morton, who rarely scores, rarely shoots, has been so good defensively. It just feels like cohesively, like all the pieces are in place, if that makes sense to you. And it's not just one star player that has to do all the heavy lifting for you. Certainly it felt like Jaden Ivey had to do that last year for Purdue to be at an elite level. And obviously he's the number four pick in the NBA draft. So yes, he was an elite player. He kind of felt like Carson Edwards had to do that at times for Purdue. It just feels like this group just has a little bit more cohesiveness to it. Now, look, 13 games left in a regular season. Maybe a month from now I'm singing a different tune. But at least at this point in the year, right, as we're closing in here at the end of January, there's just a lot to like about this team, and I think cohesiveness is where I'd probably start with as the number one thing that I like the most.
Rob, I don't envy Matt Painter or, I guess, any college basketball coach for that matter these days, because you got to keep players happy. And when you look at players like Trey Kaufman-Wren, Brandon Newman, especially Kaufman-Wren, though, because these guys can transfer at the drop of a hat. And tomorrow they could say, I'm in the portal. How can you keep those players happy when those guys would be starting in a lot of different programs?
And Matt has said that. As a matter of fact, Matt said that in the post game yesterday. He felt like he feels like he really has a nine-man rotation where all nine are potential starters, could be starters, and he wouldn't have a problem with that. I have heard Coach Painter answer this question, Brian, so I'm going to basically mimic what he has said. And that is, you can get out in front of that kind of stuff in the recruiting process, and which is what Coach Painter and his staff do a really good job of. They identify guys early in the recruiting process that not only can Purdue help win games on the floor, but they're going to help you win games when they're not on the floor, right? Guys are going to buy into the system. And look, there will be transfers this past season. Look at Eric Hunter Jr. playing at Butler. Look at Isaiah Thompson playing down in Florida. So there's always going to be transfers. But for the most part, when you recruit guys that you know are going to be system guys, and that Purdue's success is their number one goal, right? Not their individual success, but they want to win because they want Purdue to win. If those are the guys you're recruiting, then you're probably going to be in pretty good shape when it comes to having, you know, multiple transfers. Does Trey Kaufman-Wren want to be playing more? Obviously, yes, he does. I mean, he was the Gatorade National Player of the Year as a junior. Think about that. As a junior in high school, he was the Gatorade National – or, pardon me, the High School Player of the Year. So, yeah, does Brandon Newman want to be playing more? Of course he does. But as long as you have a bunch of guys, as I said, who winning is the number one goal, then you're probably going to be in pretty good shape. And that's the kind of team that Matt and his staff have put together. But, again, that starts in recruiting, right? You can't find that out the hard way after the fact. You need to identify that up front. And for the most part, over the years, Coach Painter and his staff have done that.
Well, Rob, it's certainly been a great, fun team to watch so far this year. 17-1, 6-1 in the Big Ten. I know you're having a good time this year broadcasting those games, and you will be getting an invitation for my charity golf event in June. So I can't remember the exact date, but I'll send you an invitation. Believe me. Thanks for joining us.
One of the most fun things I had on my calendar last summer. So I look forward to the invitation, Brian. Thank you.
Whether it's audiobooks or all-time greatest hits, long live listening to your favorites. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you.
Tonight at Hinkle Fieldhouse, the Butler Bulldogs take on the Creighton Blue Jays. Creighton beat Butler by 22 points back in December at Creighton. Hopefully things get turned around tonight for the Bulldogs. And joining us now, the color analyst for Butler Basketball's radio broadcast, Nick Gardner. Nick, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Brian. Thanks for having me on.
So Manny Bates is out, and it appears that this might be a prolonged absence. Is that true?
You know, to be honest, I'm not sure. It kind of sounds that way. I haven't heard anything definite on that, but boy, it sounds like kind of moving ahead in the next kind of the short term that it's going to be a similar lineup that we saw against Villanova. So I think that's safe to to kind of assume that.
So Jalen Thomas is in the starting lineup in his place, and then Ali has been moved into the starting lineup. How is this lineup different than what we saw earlier in the season?
Yeah, it is. I think it's a lot different. I think matchup-wise, number one, you add some more size on the wing when you add Ali in there, just to help out with rebound. Rebounding was an issue, you know, when Big East play started, going back to that first matchup out in Omaha. You get some more shooting. Ali's a guy who has scored, you know, at a high rate, was a top 15 scorer in the MAC, can extend the floor, can create his own shot. He's kind of a unique skill set. When you look at his size on the wing, he's more of kind of a wing forward than a guy who can kind of run the show. He's not a guy that wants to have the ball in his hands a ton. He's going to catch and shoot more often. Jalen Thomas is a little different. He's certainly got the size and shot blocking ability, but I think folks have seen with his game is more of a face-up game, a guy who can hurt you in the mid-range and can really go get rebounds out of his area. And so he's been a guy who's had a nose for the ball throughout and has brought some energy and a little more activity to that center spot.
Nick, it's Jimmy. I remember during the Big East tournament last year, a lot of my family and our Butler ties, you know, seeing Seamus Lukosius ball out against Xavier, during that win, the Big East tournament. You know, it made me think, all right, here's a budding freshman. He has experience across the pond. He's going to be a massive part of Bulldog success moving forward as he continues to grow. How important has his role been on this team? I know they're 6-0 in his career when he's, I can't remember if it was north of 20, it was in the game notes tonight, but when he's in that range, 6-0 with the Bulldogs, has a career-high 28 points. When he leads the team in scoring is what it is. They're 6-0 in those games. How has sophomore development been for Lukosius this year, and how critical was he in that winter of Villanova?
Well, he was kind of start with the ending there, Jimmy. He was fantastic, obviously. I think his ability, what makes him so unique is he's got an unbelievable feel for the game. He talks about his experience. You know, he's been playing against pros for a while, and he's got a bigger frame too. So he uses that to his advantage, and he can get going downhill, he can get guys on his hip, and then you know he's going to make kind of the right play, whether that's, you know, a kick out, whether that's a guy cutting, or whether it's him finishing at the rim. He's shown the ability to be able to do all of that and do that at a high level. And so I think you see the success of the team come because of the fact that he can make those plays for others too. So when he gets going, you know, you got to defend all areas. And if there's an opening for him to make something happen, he's going to take advantage of it. I think the progression, what you've seen is, now he made shots the other night. In Big East play, it slipped a little bit, but his three-point shooting has been much, much more consistent this season. And because of that, that's opened some things up and kept his versatility at the forefront with his offensive game. I think much like this team, you look at the consistency, though. Can you bring it night in and night out and be consistent with that production? Because, to your point, Jimmy, when you see that type of production from Seamus, it tends to be a good night for the Bulldogs. So his importance, it kind of shows with those numbers and the wins that come with it. He's got to try to be more consistent, much like the whole team does. But he's certainly a guy that oftentimes, because of his versatility, he's a huge threat. And I think with the added – look, he was playing out of position a lot early. He had to play kind of the four spot almost and had to kind of shuffle around. So that versatility didn't allow him to maybe get settled in. And I think with Ali, with Thomas, with some of those guys coming back, it's going to allow him to stay more towards his natural wing position. And I think you're going to see, hopefully, that production stay more consistent and stay at the high level that he was against Villanova. He was fantastic on Friday.
Yeah, we're talking with Nick Gardner, the color analyst for Butler Basketball on radio. Nick, with all the injuries that Thad Matta has had to deal with this year, I mean, you talk about Jalen Thomas and Ali. They pretty much missed the first half of the season. They're just now getting back, and now Manny Bates is out for who knows how long. Is this team still trying to find their identity, trying to find the right combinations?
Yeah, I think absolutely, Brian. It's you know, they're going through some of the bumps and bruises that you want to do, you know, in early November, before you or early December, before you get to Big East play. I mean, really, some of the most meaningful minutes, really the game that those guys were integrated into the lineup was UConn, right? So you're starting off against at the time what was a top five team, and having to feel things out and try to define roles and substitution patterns and all the different things that come with adding new guys to the lineup. You're trying to do that on the fly against really high-level competition. So I think that's part of the reason why you've seen some of the inconsistency from game to game. I mean, if you looked at, you know, the two games out east and then watched the Villanova game, it looked like, you know, two different teams. And I think, look, some of that is coming home. Some of that is taking your bumps on the road. But a lot of that is just the reps and the added time that you've had with those lineups and kind of figuring out what is the pecking order, what is my role to add to the formula of our team success. There's no doubt they're figuring that out. And it's good. That's why it was so good to see them figure some of that out in what was a fantastic atmosphere and a big win on Friday night at Hinkle.
Nick, to Brian's point, the first time that the Bulldogs met Creighton this year, obviously a 78-56 loss. They were still dealing with injuries and getting their lineup in order as well as they could while waiting for reinforcements to come along. Since that ball game, Bulldogs are 3-3 respectively, but have sprung together some wins like we talked about when we last spoke in December in Big East play, Georgetown, DePaul, Villanova most recently. Manny Bates is now out, as Brian alluded to earlier. Where is this Butler team different than that December 22nd meeting against Creighton?
Well, it's a good question. I think, number one, some of those roles, back to Brian's last question, some of those roles are a little bit more defined than they were.
Sure.
And you did so in a win. So I think that's a little bit more solidified. You've got guys kind of in their more natural positions. I think especially tonight, like a guy like Jalen Thomas, he knows he's going to have to go, right? He's going to have to play the bulk of the minutes to defend Kalkbrenner. In some ways, he may be a little bit of a better matchup for Kalkbrenner just because of the way the Blue Jays utilize him. You know, Kalkbrenner's gotten better with his back to the basket. He certainly can catch it and score off the block. But a lot of his points and opportunities come with running the floor, with rim runs. They come with middle pick and roll action where they can throw some lobs. And Jalen is more of a face the basket type of guy who can use his feet a little bit. Maybe that could be advantageous for the Dogs. I think ball screen defense is going to be huge. And so I think those roles are defined a lot more. But in many ways, the Dogs are still looking to kind of solidify some of those things. So they're just a little farther along in the process. But that team Friday night, if they come out with that same type of energy, that same type of intensity on the defensive end and the ball moves like it did, I think you're going to see a much improved team and hopefully much of what you saw on Friday night. But a lot of it has been so inconsistent, Jimmy, game to game. It's hard to say how much different they are a month away just because right. of how turbulent it has been kind of in between there.
To this point, there's been a big difference between Butler and the top teams in the conference. I mean, their average loss, their five losses, has been by an average of 23 points. Is there any chance of this team getting on a run and becoming a tournament team?
I think there is. I think for kind of all the things we talked about, is number one, there's talent there. I think that's been shown. I think they've shown, you know, I saw some clips that the great John Dedman released on social media after the game where Coach Mata was saying, hey, you guys, there's the bar, right? You guys set the bar. Now the challenge is, can we meet that bar and that expectation night in and night out when we're playing against these top teams? And you got to think, with that bar that they set, they're going to be able to beat some of those teams if they can do that consistently. I think the other reason why I say they can, Brian, is you look at the schedule. You know, this is going to wrap up the season series with Creighton tonight. You've yet to face Marquette. You've yet to face Xavier. So there's four matchups against top 15, top 20 opponents. You still get an opportunity to go to Providence. So there are opportunities in the Big East to go get wins that you can help pad your resume. There isn't particularly a terrible or bad loss per se. And so because of that and because of the bar that they've kind of shown they've set, I'm gonna you know, be optimistic and say, hey, if this team can put some wins together, you know, get to that, who knows what it's going to take. Is it 10? Is it 11? Is it 12 wins? Who knows? But that kind of varies on who those wins are against. And with four opportunities against a couple of those top teams and some other opportunities on the road to get some big quad one wins, I think absolutely those goals and that expectation should still be in sight for this group.
Nick, it's not, as you well know, it's not a paper schedule, right? There's easily matchups on the schedule you and I can look at, and I feel the same way as you. I want to have that optimism, and you look at maybe playing Georgetown again or home at St. John's. Like, there are wins, like you mentioned, to stack up. As you're measuring them, though, let's say they are going to be a tournament team. I know it's hard to do without Bates out there, without full strength, as they continue to shift starting lineups out there, but what do you want to see from this Bulldogs team, not just against Creighton tonight, but a road trip against Connecticut? Like you mentioned, out east, the Dogs have struggled at times. What do you want to see out of them outside of the obvious, which is wins, when they have those steal-a-game signature wins they could add to the schedule?
Well, I think you kind of bottle up what you saw on Friday night, Jimmy. I thought, look, oftentimes you can make up for what may be imperfect, you know, a technical aspect by playing with energy and playing with enthusiasm and doing it together. And I thought that's what you saw in droves on Friday. You saw four guys really accepting their roles and trying to thrive in them. You know, I think specifically a guy like Jaden Taylor, who is going to have much better and has had much better offensive games, but his imprint on that game and his defense of Caleb Daniels in the second half was huge. I mean, Villanova was, they had found a matchup that they were going to, it looked like they were going to ride the whole way. And Jaden was able to rise to the occasion. And boy, I thought his defense was impressive. And he didn't score a ton of points, but his impact on the game was massive. And so I think just kind of bottling up that type of energy and effort and togetherness that you saw on Friday. Look, there's going to be nights where you make more shots than you miss. But I think typically if you show that enthusiasm and you play with that level of urgency, you know, those shots are going to start falling and those balls may start bouncing your way because you get rewarded for that effort and that energy. And so if anything, you want to see a consistent effort and energy, and then some of those other things will tend to fall into place if you have a mindset like that.
Tonight is Project 44 night, which honors the legacy of Andrew Smith, the center that played on those final four teams, those national championship game teams that passed away from leukemia. It encourages people to donate to the Bone Marrow Registry. Always a special night at Hinkle Fieldhouse, Nick.
Oh, no doubt. No doubt, Brian. And, you know, the impact that Project 44, that Samantha Smith have had and the lives saved are touching. And it's a really simple thing. And if you're not if you're not aware of it, you can register for the National Bone Marrow Registry. It's a simple swipe of the cheek. I'm sure there'll be spots at Hinkle tonight if you're there, or you can go to Be the Match where you can find those things. And this is always a special one. It's cool this year too, Brian. We've been able, this will be the second Project 44 game. When we played out at Penn State earlier this year, the connection with Micah Shrewsbury and his support of Project 44. So you saw the Project 44 shirts for that game. One of the first games away from Hinkle Fieldhouse, I believe, to have that. And now we get our annual one at Hinkle to support Andrew. And it's a great cause. It's easy to do, and it is hugely impactful for so many. So want to always pub that. And, again, it's a really easy thing to do, and it goes a long way towards touching so many.
Well, well said. And, hey, there's going to be a lot of big-time recruits there tonight, too, including the stud from Kokomo, Flory Badunga. So do whatever you can, Nick, to get him to sign on the dotted line to go to Butler.
Well, I'll tell you what. Hopefully it's an atmosphere like we had on Friday, guys. I don't know if either of you happened to be there. I know both of you are at Hinkle quite a bit, but it was one of those nights, right, where the juice was there. I've talked to so many people who it was like, it's fun to win, obviously, but the atmosphere was one of those fun nights at Hinkle. And so hopefully we can replicate that, because if you're sitting there watching that one, you'd be hard pressed not to want to come do that throughout your college career. So it's a fun atmosphere, and look, this is a big-time game. So another opportunity, and hopefully we can get Hinkle rocking again.
Absolutely. If you have a chance, get out to Hinkle Fieldhouse tonight. Nick, thanks for joining us, and good luck tonight. Have a good broadcast.
Thanks, Nick.
Thanks, guys. Take care.
Whether it's audiobooks or all-time greatest hits, long live listening to your favorites. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you.
Pacers in action. We're in action yesterday against the Milwaukee Bucks, as the NBA, such a major date on the calendar, is Martin Luther King Jr. Day, having their marathon of basketball games throughout the afternoon. Pacers involved With that, falling to the Milwaukee Bucks and covering that contest was Tony East. Tony, right off the bat, you fired this tweet off last night, so I got to ask you, any truth to the rumors that you're trying to pitch the NBA for longer reviews?
I don't know what happened, but I swear that NBA reviews for Valve and everything are just 5 to 10 minutes long this year. I joked earlier this season wondering how far I could run in a straight line during an NBA review. It's got to be close to a quarter mile at this point. They're so long.
Hey, I would sign up for that live stream. If you ever want to try that one day, I'd be totally down for it. Yesterday afternoon, have a lead against the Bucks in the fourth, couple different runs that sunk the Pacers at times. Where did things go in your mind in this one? And obviously having Miles back, but another game without Tyrese Halliburton, how have things flowed or not so much on that end for the Pacers these last couple of games?
Yeah, these runs have been killing them since Halliburton's injury, right? They had a really good fourth quarter in New York after his injury, and they played mostly well against Atlanta. But against Atlanta, right, they were up 99-90 in the fourth and gave the game away late, and they gave a big 14-0 run in the third quarter, right? Memphis was pretty good in the fourth quarter during the competitive part of it the next day and had a 29-9 run in the second quarter. And we saw it again against Milwaukee last night with the Pacers up 107-105 with like 7.5 minutes to go. And then the Bucks completely dominate the rest of the game, right? This is part of where they miss Tyrese Halliburton the most, is they get in these stretches where they just can't slow a team down enough or score enough to slow down a run, right? There's no way for them to stop the momentum. They're taking the ball out of the basket, and then they can't score, and it just spirals and spirals. And it hasn't been the same guys on the court every time for all these runs against different teams, but it's happened in every game they've played without him, and it's costing them big time, right? They had a big problem with this last year as well, where they would give up seemingly, you know, a 10-0 run at an untimely time or just an unstoppable momentum sequence, and, you know, it's killing them. The Bucks are good. They made 23 threes. Like, it's a tough game to win even without Tyrese Halliburton, and they played a little differently without him, but that game specifically, you know, they shot really well. They actually played well enough to win until that fourth quarter stretch where the Bucks were just unstoppable. The Pacers have got to figure out how to slow down some of these runs.
That's four straight losses now for the Pacers. And when you look at the rest of the month, they're at the Nuggets Friday, at the Suns on Saturday, home with the Bulls, at Orlando, home with the Bucks, at Memphis. That seems to be a real important stretch as far as this season goes.
It does, yeah. They lost Halliburton at a tough time in terms of opponent quality and timing. You know, they've got some back-to-backs in there as well. When they come home when they have their easiest game, Orlando, I think it's a back-to-back right after they play Chicago, right?
So right.
Their schedule is really tough. They've got a road trip mixed in, and they don't have their best player for the whole stretch. Like, in a season where things were looking good, right, they reached the halfway point with 23 wins, and there are all these questions about do they need to change their direction pretty soon. All of a sudden, it's, well, hold on. Can they even survive this, you know, 2-3 weeks, whatever it is, without Tyrese Halliburton? So they play tough games. They play really quality opponents who are either in need of a win or on fire. Memphis has won 10 in a row now, you know, for example. So outside of Phoenix, who's struggling, like every team they play in the next couple weeks is playing pretty good basketball right now. They need to figure something out in terms of, you know, just general consistency for a 48-minute game to get some wins if they don't want the tune of their season to completely change.
You know, I was talking to some people inside the organization, and they want to keep Miles. They want to keep Buddy Hield. What is your sense on what they might do, if anything, before the trade deadline?
Yeah, if they keep those guys, it seems like they'll be pushing their timeline forward slightly or significantly, really, since those are two key vets. But in that case, you know, they were in the sixth spot before Halliburton's injury. Like, they were a playoff-level talent team this season. If that's the sense that they have, then it seems like they would look for guys who can be a part of both this year's team for like a small push at the end of this season and still be good and impactful on future Pacers teams, right? Helpful to them next year, the year after, whatever, because eventually this cap space they have a ton right now, right? That's very unusual for a team that's actually winning at a decent clip to have a ton of space. It's going to go away, right? You have to pay Benedict Mathurin in 4 years, Tyrese Halliburton in 2 years, and you get the idea. This is not a forever situation where they just have all the time in the world to figure out what they want. So if they love this core and want to lock into it and try to build on it and make it the team that they build with for the future, that they've got to think about a player or players or moves in general, if it's not trading for someone, that both can make them better this year if they do want to keep those guys and try to contend now and keep them good in future seasons. So if that's, you know, a young player under contract for a long time, or the right package of players and picks in a deal for their young players and picks, whatever it is, I think that's what they would look for in a situation where they do hold on to both Miles Turner and Buddy Hield.
Yeah, because if you do keep Miles, which, you know, he's a free agent, so that's, you know, that's up in the air. And Buddy Hield, if you are able to keep both of them, you really don't have many other options, do you?
That's right. That's your team right there. You know, and they like all those guys right there. They've been really good this year at times, and they're good players. But you know, it certainly is that locking into your team in year one of a rebuild would be pretty interesting given the way that, you know, they built to this point. But certainly if they're good enough to think that, you know, they add a piece here or there, or make the right draft pick next year with three or four picks, that they're close, right? That they have all this flexibility to make these options. But if this is the team that they believe in, they have to build around those guys and not instead of those guys. So it kind of changes the thinking. It changes the players you would go after. And it makes their flexibility all the more interesting, right? Do they use it now? Do they use it in the summer? All this timing elements become way more fascinating if Turner and Hield remain on the team.
Tony East, nice enough to spend some time with us via the Mower Shop and Fishers Hotline, themowershop.com, for all your residential commercial mowers, as well as snow blowers, parts, equipment, power tools, so much more. They have you covered at the Mower Shop and Fishers and themowershop.com. You can follow Tony on Twitter at TEastNBA. Tony, I know this next question isn't fair, but life isn't fair in the NBA. The Pacers want to be obviously on a fast track to be a contender. They're trending in the right direction, or at least looked that way for the first half of the season. But we point to an absence of Tyrese Halliburton and there being shortcomings and the inability to close out or respond to runs well. They have these lapses. And I know it's a small sample size, but Giannis Antetokounmpo and Chris Middleton weren't out there for the Bucks last night, and they were able to outlast in this heavyweight fight. Again, I know it's only one game, and I know the Bucks are 2 years removed from an NBA championship, so they are truly a contender. But what does that say about maybe the Pacers still being a piece or two away if they have these type of lapses without such a key cog in Tyrese Halliburton in year two here in Indiana?
Yeah, even when Tyrese was playing, right? Like they lost that game to the Knicks, not this week, but in, you know, right before Christmas when they fell to 15-16, and you know they had an ugly clutch performance that day, and only I think they scored 108 points, right? Like, yeah, they were on fire for a little bit there with some great clutch play before Halliburton's injury, but they were still like, you know, hardly over a 500 team. I mean, they were like a 55% win percentage team. It's not like they were, you know, so awesome or close. That's why, them going for it this year has always been a little surprising to me in terms of them being like buyers necessarily, because it's not like they were so awesome before his injury. I mean, they were definitely good. You know, sixth in the East is not something to shrug at. Like, that's very impressive, especially considering where they were last season. They've done a great job building this team, but it's not like they were so far over 500 that it should drastically change the way that they build their squad. But that said, you know, the fact that they were just, you know, whatever you want to say, a 500 team, a 55% win percentage team, you know, whatever tier you want to put them in the East, you lose your best player, you're going to be much worse. And the problem with it is he makes everybody else better, right? Halliburton not only is good himself, he makes Buddy Hield a threatening shooter. He makes the lanes open for all these other guys to play really well. So losing him also makes their other guys worse, and that's where you feel like they would need another dude, right? Mathurin is great, but he's a rookie. He's not necessarily good at creating for others yet. If they could get another piece on their team, it would not only be adding talent, it would be adding another player that lets their other players be as good as possible, even if they have other injuries on the team. So, yeah, they're clearly still something away, right? I think that was obvious even at full health, but especially in the stretch where they've lost four in a row for the first time this season and are missing their best player, they clearly need something else on this team long term.
We still have a month until this really becomes prevalent within the Pacers front office. I'm sure they're thinking about it right now, but Miles Turner returns last night. He drops 30. Anytime he's out there, he's a difference maker for this team. But that looming ghost that you and I have joked about the last couple of months, Tony, is that you cannot afford to let him walk for nothing if extension talks break down. And obviously there's a gap of about 3 or 4 weeks between the trade deadline and when an extension can still be done. How much is the sweat starting to drip at all? And do you have any lean one way or the other of if an extension does not get done between these two sides, that a trade would ultimately be imminent after that?
Yeah, this stretch right now is pivotal for basically all of that stuff. You know, and it's, if you're Turner, you understand that, you know, they just tried to sign DeAndre Ayton this summer, right? Like, is that contract your starting point for you in negotiations? And if you're the Pacers, do you say, well, we don't want to give you that much? You know, there's all sorts of factors at play that make it hard to immediately come to an extension agreement, even though the Pacers have this unique cap situation that allows them to extend him in a way that no other team in the NBA possibly could. There's a lot to consider for Turner and for the Pacers in terms of where they start, where they go with negotiations. That's why I think that the initial offers from both sides would be laughed at by the other party. That said, though, right, like if the Pacers are, you know, whatever, 25 and 28 at the start of February, for example, do they really want to be, you know, rushing into this core? Maybe they do, right? Maybe they, and that's fine. But then they have a month to figure it out with Turner, and that's really risky, right? Like before the trade deadline, the Pacers have some control of the situation. As soon as February 10th comes, if Miles Turner's on the team, they have absolute zero control, right? He has all the control. He's the only one that can sign anything and you know, decide his long-term future with this team or any other team. So, you know, they have to be proactive in this time before February 9th. Like, yes, March 1st is the deadline for a renegotiation and extension, but truly they have to think of February 9th as a different deadline because that's when they lose power. So how they play in the interim and make decisions is really going to matter, I think, in this situation. Like, if they start to win some games again, maybe they think, okay, we really want to lock into what we have. If they start to lose some more, then maybe they're more willing to negotiate with other teams. But I think it's all gonna come to head in the next couple weeks, more so than that March 1st deadline, just because the Pacers lose control at that point.
I don't think the Pacers want to sign Miles Turner to a max contract, but do you think there's somebody out there that might?
Oh, a max? I would be pretty surprised if someone signed him to a max deal. You know, the thing about his contract that's so interesting is, you know, he was signed like with salary cap like 20 to 30 million lower, right? So even at just going on the percent of the cap, if he is the same exact player he was when he signed this deal, he's probably worth like 24, 25 million right now. And that sounds like a high number. People forget how much the salary cap goes up in the league. But a max player, you know, DeAndre Ayton just got, for example, like the 25% max at about 30 million per year when the Pacers signed him. Like, is he worth that much? Ayton hasn't even been that good for the Suns this year. They're a pretty crummy team since the start of December, since they lost Devin Booker. You know, how much do you want to commit to a center in today's NBA? I don't think any team would be willing to give Miles Turner maximum money, but, you know, this last summer, for example, we saw Yusuf Nurkic sign, you know, for $17.5 million a year, or Mitchell Robinson get $15 to $16 million a year, right? Those guys aren't as good as Miles Turner, right? So he's clearly worth at least 20, likely more, given that he makes 18 now and is certainly a better player than when he signed that deal. So is he a max guy? I don't think so in the current landscape of the NBA, and I don't think anyone with the max space is going to be rushing to give him that kind of money. But I do think he's worth, you know, in the mid-20s, you know, maybe a 100-year deal over – $100 million deal over 4 years, if that makes sense.
Tony, you know as well as anybody that Coach Carlisle continues to preach, particularly in press conferences, both on – the effort and level of energy that his teams bring, but also just the physicality on the defensive end and having these at times, you know, ugly, not every night, but have these ugly old era style basketball games on that side of the ball. You emphasize in your last post for All Pacers on Sports Illustrated, the last three games, the Pacers have not been as sharp defensively. You did put the caveat in there, hey, Miles Turner wasn't in there for two of those three games, but they still looked lost against Milwaukee. With the way, almost in response games, Coach Carlisle is able to get his group back on track, are you worried about the defense long term with Halliburton out of there, or is this something that now that Miles is back, you expect this to be more fine-tuned and more back to what we saw the first 2 months of the season?
Yeah, I think it'll be a little better than it was last night in their next couple of games. Right? Milwaukee hit an insane number of three-pointers. Last 23 is just a, like, that's the Pacers franchise record, right? Milwaukee just ho-hum chucked them up and made them in that game. You know, they were really good shooting the ball. That said, the Pacers definitely had some breakdowns, and Halliburton himself is not necessarily the best defender right now. Like, I think even he would admit that, but, you know, he at least, when he's in there, their offense is so much better that the other team is taking the ball out of the basket and has to play in the half court more. Like, that helps your defense somewhat, even if the personnel isn't awesome. Whereas now without him, their offense isn't as good, so there's more transition fast break, and Mathurin's been the guy replacing him in the starting five. And, you know, he's a nosy defender. He certainly plays with a lot of force, but again, rookies typically struggle on the defensive end. So I think that personnel wise, they'll be a little bit worse defensively, just in turn of what they lost with the Halliburton injury. But I think, you know, they didn't play like awful defense last night. The Bucks hit some crazy shots, especially in that second half. Drew Holiday, Bobby Portis, Jordan Nwora were just, it felt like every three that took went in, even though only half of them actually did. So I'd imagine against, you know, worse shooting teams or lesser offensive teams, OKC, Phoenix right now isn't playing very well, won't shoot that well. I think their defense will look better as time progresses without Halliburton, but certainly in the couple of games they've played recently, it has not looked good. It's something they really need to clean up if they want to get some wins again.
All right, put your general manager's hat on. What would you add to this team to improve it?
they need a power forward desperately, right? And they've look, since Thad Young, that's been the position that they've wanted, needed, whatever word you want to use to caveat it, right? They tried starting Sabonis there because he was their best player, and that makes some sense. You put your best five players on the court when you can, but he's not a natural four, right? It was hard for him to chase around guys on that end of the floor defensively, right? Their best season they've had in the Kevin Pritchard GM era is the only season, or one of the only seasons, excuse me, that they had Thaddeus Young at the four, and he was awesome on defense. He was a great connecting piece on offense. He had the size to do it. Even this year's Pacers team has a lot of success when O'Shea Brissett's in the game off the bench or with the starters, wherever he ends up playing, because he's so natural at that position. So if I'm the Pacers' decision makers in some way, and I think this has been reported by many people, you know, they want a four, they need a four that can either fit in with the starting five as a four and give them a little more size, or just give them more depth at that position, because currently they're playing some guards or some tinier forwards at that spot a lot of the time, and that's not quite tenable long-term, especially if they're going to be a playoff team.
Tony East joining us via the Motor Shop and Fishers hotline and themotorshop.com. You can follow him on Twitter at TEastNBA. Tony, I know that you especially are going to leave no stone unturned as you continue to follow the Pacers beat and look at what is going to happen towards the deadline. But despite me wanting, when he was drafted, a go, ga, go chant to eventually establish at Gainbridge Fieldhouse, never came to fruition for the big man. And now Yahoo Sports, in an article you referenced, saying that if there is a big man to be traded, it most likely could be Goga Batadze. Is that a similar feel you have? And is there interest in general in the 23-year-old?
That just makes a lot of sense to me, like even beyond what he has or hasn't done on the court, just looking contractually at him, right? If you're the Pacers and you have this new long-term thinking approach that you talked about this offseason, and you know, you're in year one of whatever you want to call this, a rebuild, a retool, a new project, whatever you want to call what they're doing. You know, and anyone on an expiring contract, you at least have to think about their future instead of losing them for nothing. And Batadze is on an expiring contract, and sure, he can be a restricted free agent, but he's their, you know, fourth big right now, and not looking like minutes will be there for him anytime soon, especially if they keep Turner. So even beyond any, you know, rotation minutes that he is or isn't getting and anything like that, or him developing into a certain type of player, you know, it just makes sense for them to explore what deals could be like for him. And I think Fisher's report called out that, you know, they would work together with the Tide's representation to, if the right opportunity was there, and that Goga not necessarily wanting to take G League assignments to get minutes, right? He's only played in five games since December started, so all the context shows that he's really not a part of their current plans, even nonetheless their future plans at his current age. So that pick did not turn out the way they had hoped when they made it, and they have other bigs on the team, both some at his age, some like Miles Turner, who are, you know, their starter and look like they want to keep him potentially. It would just make sense that they would look to move him, or, you know, try to find a situation where he could play. As for where, you know, look at any of the teams that either don't have a quality backup big, like San Antonio, for example, who's been, you know, Gorgie Jang's been getting a lot of minutes for them off the bench. They waived him and then brought him back on a 10-day. That could be a fit, for example. Or Charlotte doesn't have the greatest big man rotation. They play a lot of Nick Richards and Mark Williams. A team like that that maybe has some minutes for him, especially as a young player who is about to enter restricted free agency. But it's tough, right? He doesn't play enough to build a lot of value. So it's hard to say what any team would be willing to, you know, clear a spot for him or really want to give up something for him. But that said, I'm sure he would like to go somewhere where he could potentially play a little bit more than he is.
Yeah, but what are you going to get for him? I mean, that trade isn't going to be a difference maker in any way.
No, I don't think that's a trade to get something necessarily. I think that's more, okay, you know, this guy's not in our plans. We can get him somewhere that makes more sense for him, and maybe, you know, open a roster spot or get a very, very protected second-round pick that they can use in a different deal, right? It's not necessarily about getting something, but more so the flexibility it would provide.
If you had to put a sizable wager down, is this Pacers a playoff team or not?
Man, it's tough. I mean, I don't think they're one of the best six teams in the East. You know, the sixth best team is the Knicks, who have already beaten them twice this year, and they're close, I think. You know, at their best, they've beaten some very good teams, right? Boston, New Orleans already this season, and Cleveland. You know, they've beaten some good teams. They look the part, but when the game would slow down in the postseason, and, you know, as time goes on and some of these rookie wall moments maybe happen with some of their younger guys, I think they're probably just outside that mix right now. I think they're probably closer to the 7-8-9 range in the East, and that puts you in the play-in, which means you're, you know, a coin flip or so from the playoffs, but I'd say right now they're just outside of that top eight in the Eastern Conference.
Tony, Brian asked you this earlier, but you look at the importance of these next couple of games, not just this road trip, but just in general when you have matchups against the Bulls, the Bucks again, the Suns, the Nuggets in this stretch as well. For where this team is at and the balancing act of trying to be a playoff team and potentially going the other way, These offensive struggles with Tyrese Halliburton have been evident, but McConnell had a great game last night, a career high for him, I believe, by halftime, and then Miles Turner drops 30. Who do you need to step up on offense as these tough road trips and then the rest of this meat and potatoes of the January schedule unfold to keep yourself afloat in the playoff race?
Yeah, my answer is Andrew Nembhard, definitely, right? The guy who is directly replacing your star at the starting point guard spot. And look, he not only is playing bigger minutes, but he's playing a totally different role for the Pacers right now, right? Like, he was playing off the ball all the time. And, you know, if you look at his stats, like, he shoots the ball really well when he plays with Tyrese Halliburton. Makes, like, 60% of his twos and 40% of his threes. And those numbers drop significantly when he plays without Tyrese Halliburton, right? And so he has had to change the way he's played, not only just his role, right, but the way he gets shots, the openness of those shots. And he has not been hitting them. His decision-making, especially with his shooting, has not been very crisp these couple games. I think he went 2-for-16 against Atlanta last week and has gone 2-for-9 and 3-for-9 in the two games since. His passing is still really good. Like, when he gets in the paint or when he sees an open teammate or reads the play, he is pretty good, especially for a rookie at getting the ball to the right person at the right time and all that sort of stuff you need a point guard to do. But his scoring has not been there. His self-creation has not been there. And he could step up and just give them another on-the-ball threat that, you know, makes life a little easier for Mathurin and Turner and Hield on offense, as well as adding to his threat level when he's not just a passer, right? He's basically been just that for them these last couple of games. That would really help them. Ball handling is so important, especially for young teams that need organization. And, you know, if they have 15 turnovers and can't quite get the self-creation they need from their point guard spot, they're not going to win many games without Tyrese Halliburton.
I can't think of many second-round picks that end up being in a starting lineup. Can you? Like Nembhard?
No, it's very rare. It's very rare. Yeah, he has been such a good story for this team, right? And especially on defense. Like, usually rookies are really bad defenders in the NBA, quite frankly. And the fact that he can read the game and time his swipes with his hands and stay in front of guys and, you know, stick with the scouting report. I mean, he's been awesome on that end of the floor. That is so rare. And, you know, finally, the praise has on a national level kind of reached, like, oh, wow, you know, he's really good that they got with this 31st pick in the draft. And, yes, it's super rare that second-round picks even get minutes, you know, in their first season, nonetheless start. So he's been a revelation for this team.
Tony, I know that Brian already made you put on the general manager hat, but if you're looking at where moves might happen, Buddy Hield was a name that early on, upon his arrival, it's like, okay, this is maybe a season or two at most, or season and a half or so, and then he's going to get dealt. If Turner is reaching an extension, or the belief is that there's an extension going to be made there, and you're at the point of Hield being 30, you know, in a couple of years you're going to have to make a decision on him. Where, if anywhere, outside of Bataze, are there legitimate assets for these Pacers to try to add another piece to still compete this year or get themselves younger or whatever avenue that Kevin Pritchard wants to take? If Hield and Turner are off the board, where's the direction at the deadline for this team?
Yeah, Heald's an interesting spot because he's not an expiring deal. They don't have to rush into anything if they like him. And he's, and you know, this is maybe the best he's played over the course of a full season in his career, up there with 2018-19. So if, you know, if Goga's not fetching you anything, what are the moves, right? Like, how can they get better? That's a good question. And the answer is the draft picks, right? They are loaded on them in the upcoming draft. They've got their own, which right now is going to be, you know, I think 18 to 20 range last time I checked. And they've got Cleveland's and Boston's, which are both in the bottom five of the first round. But they also, if things break their way, have Houston's second round pick, but only if it's in the top two of the second round. I'm not going to get into all the protections. It's insane and not worth the time of explaining on the radio. But there's a chance that if things break their way and Houston remains one of the two worst teams in the league, they would have four top 32 picks, right? And given what the Pacers have and what it looks like they will have next year, even if they trade both Turner and Hield, for example, what they would have next year, like, they don't have room for four rookies who need minutes, right? So those picks, it seems like, would be the things that you'd look at for them to try to find their upgrades, right? Can they trade three of them for somebody pretty good? Can they trade two of them for somebody who's kind of good? You know, that sort of deal seems like the thing that would make the most sense for them, given what they have, what they need, and the fact that they can't bring in that many players next year. Maybe they end up dealing them for future picks at the time of the draft if they can't find the right deal, but it just doesn't make any sense for them to have that young of a team if they're trying to be better now, and especially if they keep Hield and Turner. So I would look for those to be something that, you know, they would try to move if they look for upgrades.
To clarify that point, are those picks in the kind of treasure chest of picks that they have, are those assets they are looking more towards moving up in June's draft or utilizing as bargaining chips the deadline?
Yeah, I think it would depend on, right, the next couple of weeks, honestly.
Sure.
You know, if they reach February 4th, whatever date they mark on the calendar as their decision date, I don't even know if that's a thing that they have, but you get the idea. You know, if they figure out the timing and they say, okay, you know, we've lost too many games in this stretch without our best player, it's you know, the Knicks are whatever, five, six games ahead of us now. We can't get to the sixth seed. You know, maybe then they decide that they'll try to move up in the draft with them and add one more really young piece. But if they're, you know, right in the thick of that 6, 7, 8 mix and think they can make the postseason or make waves in the play-in, perhaps then, you know, they would say, okay, let's try to move some of these first and help right now and make the playoffs this year and then build on that team in the future. Because postseason experience is valuable, right? Every time they have a game with a playoff-style atmosphere, Carlisle calls it out to us. He calls it out to the players. He lets everybody know that this is what it's going to be like. They have a lot of guys who have not played in a playoff game, and I think that experience would be pretty valuable for this young team.
Tony, always appreciate your work. Of course, you can find your work on All Pacers, on Sports Illustrated, and Locked On Pacers, as well as their site, but also on the podcast. Anything else you want to plug before we bid farewell?
No, that's great. Thank you, Jimmy. Much appreciated.
Appreciate you, Tony. Thanks for taking the time.
Thanks, Tony.
Thanks, guys.